This audio is brought to you by Business Radio, powered by Wharton, originally airing on SiriusXM.
From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School,
this is Leadership in Action on Business Radio.
Welcome to Leadership in Action, SiriusXM's Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm Mike Hussein, Director of the Center for Leadership and Change. Here on Zoom, in fact, with my friend and colleague, Ann Greenhall. Our third host, Jeff Klein, is teaching today, so won't be joining us. But I do want to remind everybody that new episodes of our show premiere every Friday at 9 a.m. here on Business Radio, SiriusXM channel 132. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter at SXM Business. So, Ann, great to be here with you. Before we jump in, how was the week that was for you?
Oh, well, very good, Mike. Good week. As you know, we are looking ahead to the fall semester and doing our planning. And we realize that we need to be flexible. We know how to teach in person. We know how to teach virtually. And I'm thinking that we're going to have to know how to teach in a hybrid way. So I'm looking forward to getting another skill in my toolkit, Mike.
And you are the art of leadership, which is adaptability and agility. So who knows what's going to happen September 1, in person, not in person, hybrid or whatever. You're ready for all the above, I hear.
Exactly. And how about for you, Mike? What's top of mind for you?
The same thing for me. Everybody's feels like we're on kind of pins and needles, waiting to see what does happen, but we've got to be ready for several different avenues, hopefully all in person, what we will see.
Right.
And speaking of that, Anne, we actually have one of our students with us today. So let me introduce our distinguished guest. Kunal Khatri is the Trade Commissioner for the U.S. from the U.K. So he's based at the British Consulate General in New York. But he also, by going back a couple sentences here, is enrolled in our executive MBA program, which requires that on weekends he somehow get from New York to here to take coursework on a Friday and Saturday. I know the program well. I've been teaching in it for some time. So, Kunal, with that said, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. I'm delighted to join you today.
Let me offer our listeners a couple more pieces of background information about you. You have spent 5 years before your current posting here in the U.S. at the British Embassy in Beijing as Britain's Minister, Counselor, and Director for Financial and Professional Services. You've been with the Treasury there in London. You worked with the World Bank, the UN, and even The Economist. You're a graduate of Oxford and the London School of Economics. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, you're currently also in the Executive MBA program, or MBA program for executives, as we officially call it here at the Wharton School. So, Kunal, let me begin with sort of an obvious bridge off the last point. The Executive MBA program is a weekend program for working professionals. You are one. So basically during the week of classes, Monday through Thursday, you're hard at work, and then Friday you're up here. So, so far, how's it going? Working full-time and in school full-time as we consider it. How's it going?
Well, on top of that, we have two little kids. We have a one-year-old and a three-year-old who are not very respectful of homework time. So it's definitely been hard. It's been a lot more work in my own time than I had anticipated. I always knew that was coming, but it's more than I imagined. But I'm still early days in it, but it's really been invaluable. There's a lot of core technical concepts and content, economics, accountancy, which building blocks for business. And they just help me understand in my role when I speak to business. But what I'm really applying very quickly is a lot of the content in the strategy classes, both human, social capital, how you lead teams, how you motivate teams. But also my day job is speaking to businesses and understanding how they think about their next step, their next development, their next cross-border opportunity. It's really invaluable thinking through that and how to speak to business.
So, Kunal, I can't resist asking you about the work-life, not balance, but the work-life contour. You're doing two things at once. You've got a family, young children, working full-time for the British government, and in effect, we consider it a full-time enrollment in our MBA program. Two questions based on that. What led you to enroll? And then for people who are trying to balance four or five balls in the area, in the air, what are one or two details of your life that you might share as to how the heck you do that?
Yeah. So the first question, why to enroll? So as you said, my career, it has been economics, financial services, and global. It's been cross-market to China and the US. I spent a lot of my time talking to business, advising business on policy, regulation, how to enter a market, find the partnerships. But that only goes to a certain level of depth. And there was that next layer of intricate understanding how a business judges what to do, which I don't have an experience of. I've never worked in a business. I have worked closely with businesses, including my first job with the Treasury was during the financial crash. And we worked on the rescue of Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds. So I really wanted to complement and build out that side. The second is more about that leadership and strategic side, where we obviously do a lot of training around that in government, but there is a growing recognition and understanding that we need to be learning and leveraging more from private and business sector leadership as well. So I really wanted to open up that side to understand. And it's absolutely fascinating looking at case studies from Netflix to Southwest Airlines, examples which we don't really talk about in government because we're government. We talk about public administration, but there's a lot you can actually draw and learn from that as well.
Well, before we go to the other question about how you are balancing off two full-time commitments, let me just make an observation and see if this kind of has a kernel of truth to it or not. And that is, in public policy, we are talking about policy. You've just said this. Mm-hmm. Policies on exchange rates or interest rates. But a lot of what happens in international trade is, of course, affected by such rates, but often comes down to what senior executives think their company ought to be doing in light of its circumstance. So I hear you saying to kind of fill out your understanding of how the heck the world operates, it's good to know how the mind of a business executive operates as well. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's exactly right. I think, you know, I have been part of policy processes, which have been an excellent collaboration of bringing in business intelligence, NGOs, multilaterals, as a commission. And I've been through experiences where actually we're operating in silos and it comes to a head when policy crashes against business and it's gone wrong. Yeah. So, you know, the effect of doing the MBA is partly to avoid those circumstances in my life. I can actually understand where business are coming from. And in a future world, if I'm in a business, I can understand where government is coming from. Yep. And a big attraction for Wharton and for, you know, not new anymore, but Dean Erica James, was this real emphasis on public-private collaboration for tackling so many of the challenges we face domestically and globally. They can't just be done in isolation. So that was a real appeal.
Totally. Let me hold off on my second question and bring Anne in. Anne, why don't you jump right in with both feet here.
Oh, thank you, Mike. And Kunal, so great to have a chance to speak with you. I was very interested in your response to Mike's question. And what I hear in the response is that pursuing education at Wharton for you is a matter about getting more knowledge, content on the one hand, and also greater skills. And in particular, the leadership skills, the teamwork skills. So I'm going to ask a question that maybe is a little personal, but we're talking here about knowing and doing, and I'd like to ask about being. In other words, how has the education so far had an effect on you, on who you are, and how you take up your roles?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I think it's right. It's about the knowledge and skills, but part and parcel of that is the challenge. You know, I've chosen this course to be challenged. I did look at public policy, public administration, very much my wheelhouse, and I wanted to get out of that into the deep end. So that actually then relates to the personal being, where first thing to say, I've had more than a few moments of being out of depth. And actually, you know, it's been a long time since going back to university and having that feeling and feeling that pressure doing an exam. So there's an element of, this comes back to Mike's question, that resilience and management. How am I going to bring this all together? You know, it's really pushing and testing me how I manage in my life, manage my time, and, you know, stretching a wonderfully understanding wife who is inevitably picking up some of the slack with the kids as well. Mm-hmm. I think the other element is, this comes more to a career trajectory, is it's really giving that moment to reflect and ask from first principles, am I where I want to be? And where do I want to go next? And it's very rare you take that time, carve that time to do that kind of question, but also have the ecosystem and environment to challenge and guide you on those questions. So that's fairly early, but I knew there was a nugget of that, which is why I applied in the first place. And that is growing and, you know, expanding those questions as we go along.
Just quickly jump in and come back to you. Mm-hmm. You need to remind everybody that this is Leadership in Action, Business Radio, Sirius XM, Channel 132. I'm your host, Mike Yuseem. Mm-hmm. I'm here with Ann Greenhall. And our guest for the hour is Kunal Khatri, who is the United Kingdom's Acting Trade Commissioner for the USA, based at the British Consulate in New York City. Ann.
Oh, thank you, Mike. When Kunal, when you describe the experience so far, you remind me of expressions that we use on Leadership in Action, and that is the value of those stretch experiences that put you a little bit outside of your comfort zone. And then you've also raised a hobby horse of mine, and that is the value of reflection, of thinking deeply, not superficially, but deeply about where you are and where you might want to head. So I'm just curious, are there any preliminary insights of where you're headed?
Yeah. I think one of the biggest impacts has been, and this is going to sound incredibly obvious, but bear in mind, I come from 15 years of government, is just how fascinating business is across business strategy, leadership, you know, cross-border. I am a political nerd. I come from a political policy background, and I get fascinated, and my career has been built around policy challenges. But as I said earlier, those challenges can't be done in buckets and silos anymore. Right. And it is absolutely fascinating hearing of business stories and how they've tackled similar challenges. Mm-hmm. And the bigger story for me personally is I'm very conscious as I go through this, just how much I close down avenues through my career, through my own leadership. I was like, government, I'm going to do something at the World Bank, something at the UN. I'm going to branch out to The Economist, which is not really branching out, it's still political. And then I'm going to go back to government. And, you know, reflecting through this MBA, you know, is that appreciation of I've cut off a whole world of experience and development simply because it didn't fit in a framework I had built for myself. And this is a real education, real enlightenment in just opening those horizons.
Oh, Kunal, thank you so much. Mike, I'm going to hand back to you.
Yeah, Kunal, let's stay on the same area, if you don't mind, for a bit more. And to focus in now on the amazing event of some months ago, and that is the UK's exit from the European Union. It's had an enormous impact on international trade. Yeah. So just to start from kind of very little knowledge, certainly on my part, of how that's affected US-UK trade, I assume it's been dramatic. Well, what are some of the contours of what has happened in the wake of Brexit?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're about 7 months on now from the formal exit and the agreement of a transition agreement with the EU. I think what's been most striking is, pandemic aside, there are obviously pandemic effects, is how quickly US-UK trade has rebounded. Now, there was a period during Brexit and negotiations, there was obviously uncertainty, that obviously has an impact on business. But come January the 1st, there's been a very, very quick turnaround in US investor appetite towards the UK. And when I speak with US industry across all sectors, across all states, there is a real appetite now to take advantage of whatever the opportunities are for post-Brexit UK. We're already seeing, there's been a big series of announcements of how the UK will take advantage of freedoms post-Brexit. The Prime Minister has announced a green industrial strategy. So we're going to have 12 billion of investment to actually green the economy. Just earlier this month, we announced the Bayes innovation strategy. So how are we going to develop the UK as a science and technology superpower as well? So you can see there's a lot more innovation and new ideas coming out post-Brexit. And I actually think, aside from the difficulties of the pandemic, we're actually looking to new opportunities with the US.
That's great. Let me stay on this in a slightly different way. You've had now, you actually have had a look for a number of years at how businesses operate, even if you've been primarily in government up through now. But with that, and then with your experience in our executive MBA program, just to get you thinking out loud, as you look at leadership in government versus leadership in business, what are a couple of the most striking similarities and then the most striking differences?
Yeah, that's a big question. I think one of the things that I've been very struck by speaking with colleagues on the course, leadership in business versus government. In government, not just leadership, but communications, the breadth of impact that you can have as a policy official or a government minister in not just the development of policy, but what you say and what you communicate is enormous and considerably larger than a business. Now, that's even the case for the largest business. When you speak as government, that has an enormous impact and it's accessible and it's usually top page news for the entirety of the UK. And if we're here in the US, it will be across US media. So what I think you find is there are so many more hoops that we need to jump through when we have to consider what our communications is going to be. We have to consider the risks around that communication to a nth degree. And I know business does that as well. But you have to be prepared to be blindsided when it comes to government communications. And that obviously then plays into leadership as well. The thing I'd say about leadership when it comes internal in government is there is not a business on the scale of the bureaucracy of a government. It's the UK government, the US government. And that's necessarily so. Government, then its duties and responsibilities have grown over 100 years. There is, you know, very good reasons government is of the scale it is. Now, political arguments, whether it's X percent or Y percent, but it is required to be large. That makes coordination of government activity incredibly, incredibly difficult. And that is where a huge amount of time is spent on internal leadership. It is the nature of the history of our infrastructure that we'll have different budget lines, different departments, different entities, and they'll sort of come together. But actually, it's for the leader to speak to those who are clumped together to understand we're still government. We have to work as one government. We'll have different ways of being appraised or being paid or different budget lines. But it's the job of leaders, and especially when you come overseas, to understand that you're here to represent government. Nobody in the US cares really what department you're coming from. They care, can you speak as government? So there's a big job of how you try and cohere and lead that as well.
Great, super. Anne, let me bring you back in.
Yeah, well, Mike, I really appreciate your question, the leadership question, and what is similar and different when you think about leading in government and leading in business. I thought you might ask about leading in sports, Kunal. I was very interested to read your opinion piece about England standing as one in support of its football team. And I might just ask you to speak about the importance of sports as a cultural manifestation of the, you know, of the country as a whole. So just would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, sports is a reflection, manifestation of the culture of a country, but it's also a leader. It shapes the culture behaviors of a country. And that was what was so profound about this England team and the England manager in particular. Yeah. And I think it's a broader reflection of how do you lead? You can only lead in your true, authentic style and sense. I cannot pretend to be a Steve Jobs kind of leader. That's not who I am. I can only be who I am. And what I think is very striking about the players and the captain and the England manager is their own personal histories and therefore what they brought to their leadership. So Gareth Southgate, he played in the England team in 1996. He missed a penalty. It was national heartbreak because the tournament was in England.
Yeah.
But, you know, 20 years later, 25 years later, he's brought that to bear as the manager for an England team that has just been knocked out on penalties. So when he writes a letter to the nation, it's genuinely heartfelt. It's empathetic. That we all know Gareth Southgate. And, you know, we can connect with that guy who failed in 96, but has brought himself around to this moment. And the players today, to the players of 20 years ago, they all know that they are role models and they all live up to that role. Now, I remember in the 90s, big discussions that players aren't role models. They're just professional footballers. They make money, they play the game, and they can do what they like. And it was genuinely a debate. That's just not the world we're in now. That's just such significant influences. So Jordan Henderson is Liverpool captain, plays for England. He's been doing a terrific amount around inclusion, respect for LGBTQ fans. And Raheem Sterling has done a lot around race and racial inclusion and diversity. And I think it's just incredible how much power they brought to this tournament to actually lead the fan base. It's like, this is acceptable, this is not. And if you're not in our camp, they don't want you in the stadium, frankly.
Yeah.
And I'm going to break in for just a second, a very brief reminder, Anne, that you are all listening to Leadership in Action. It's Anne Greenhall and Mike Youssim here, and we are in discussion with Kunal Khatri, the acting trade commissioner for the UK based here in the US. Anne, back to you.
All right. Well, Kunal, I can't resist. You know, you speak about authenticity. And so how would you describe your own leadership style?
Yeah, I think my leadership style is quite personable and empathetic. I have tended to lead through personal connection, trying to understand the teams I work with, develop a connection on that sense. And one of the challenges I face as a leader, you know, as you move up the scale, is it's harder to have a personal connection as the team gets bigger. So how do you sustain that in a way that doesn't mean your diaries one-to-one catch-ups all day and every week? So it is a case of trying to make that time for group settings and group engagement. But I think, again, you know, you mentioned this article around the England team. I think there is one element of you can talk internally to your staff in an empathetic way about what the tournament means, what diversity and inclusion means. And that resonates so far. I think it resonates more when you show you're willing to put your neck on the line and speak to the general public and speak externally with exactly the same message. So I think there's a bit of that internal connection, internal to external. And that, you know, this article had a, you know, it landed very well. And I was very grateful for the positive feedback. But I certainly, my style of leadership is quite open book, quite personable.
Yeah, and I'm imagining, is this true? The pandemic has given a bit of a challenge to that, because you're, am I right in thinking that you've been doing, like Mike and me, more and more remotely and virtually? So how have you managed to demonstrate that empathy and that connection, even in a virtual format?
Yeah, it's really hard. Really hard to make that connection. And I also think the environment of working in the pandemic, when you are, say, an empathetic and open kind of leader, you absorb a lot more. And it gets very difficult personally, because you know everyone's going through pain. You have to be a bit of a shock absorber for that and support people through it. And that is very, you know, tiring and weary for yourself. I think there's an element of leading by example. Frankly, cutting out my diary where I'm not going to meet. I don't reply to emails because I know I've got a meeting with this person in 3 days. And I try and tell the teams, you have to consciously in this environment not reply to emails. You have to honestly ask yourself, is this going to move anything forward? Or am I just gratifying myself because I've got a view and I need to send an email? So there's trying to do bits like that, trying to reduce the traffic, reduce the need for meetings. And, you know, appreciating actually that it's going to be very hard to achieve as much as we used to in this environment. And we just have to accept we're going to fall short. That's fine. That's just fine. That's the nature of where we're in.
I could use some tips from you, Kunal, on managing the email traffic.
I'm not sure Mike, how successful it's been, but attempted.
Mike, back to you.
I'm going to ask if you can speak about what business can learn from people in politics. So you work in politics, you work in business, and just to maybe you shift the question a little bit, if you're talking with people in business and they say, well, what can I learn from leadership in politics and the public sector? what would you offer up? And then we'll flip that question around. So what is your thinking there?
Yeah. So I think what business can learn from government politics, the obvious one is around political risk. Political risk, political forecasting, regulatory trends. When I speak to US businesses, actually, that is at the top or near the top of their risk factors. We are in a profound period of political policy change. So there's an obvious expertise to bring to that. But the other I would add in a more competencies and what the skills base that government folk bring to business, we have to necessarily be very strong horizontal thinkers. You come into work, you have no idea what you're going to be blindsided by that day or that week. And it's an ability to then take that, understand how it connects to what your original plan was, but also how it connects to a risk which is far to the left, which was not really front and center, but you knew it connects. And it's that ability to think horizontally and bring all the pieces together such that you then actually have a clear way forward. It's how do you work in a nebulous environment? Now, obviously businesses do that, but I do think the breadth of policy government work is so much wider that on a day-to-day issue, we could be responding to something on climate, technology, or China, development policy, pandemic, and you need to be able to respond to that.
So let me briefly flip that around. I'll put my words in what you just said, and that is, in politics or the political, the public sphere, you really have to think about everything. You have to think strategically. There's so many moving parts and you can't ignore any. What do you think people in politics, maybe elected politicians in particular, can learn from people who run large companies? What comes to mind on that one?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, elected politicians, it goes back to what I said at the start, that, you know, we're in an environment of risk where what we say has significant impact. But what I think a key lesson from business, and this did play out well in the UK during the pandemic, was learning how and where to take risk and how to create the space for innovation in the sense of business innovation. And the example I give here is actually when it comes to vaccine development in the UK, an executive decision made very early by the Prime Minister to appoint a business leader with a large sum of money to operate almost like a venture capital firm and take bets on vaccine development and go for it. High risk, high reward, and it's paid off for the UK. You know, we have developed the vaccines and we're ahead of the curve. That's a good example, actually, of learning it. The challenge is, how do you deploy that across the rest of government? Pandemic's quite unique. It's a national level security and health risk. Take the risk. How do you deploy that at a smaller scale to actually allow risk-taking, be okay with failure, but also appreciate that longer term, that actually creates a more dynamic government and bureaucracy as well?
Very, very interesting. Anne, let's bring you in.
All right, thank you, Mike. And Mike, I'm reminded of a classic article by Drucker, "What Can Business Learn from Nonprofit and Nonprofit Learn from Business?" And one of the answers for the business side was that sense of mission, which actually lets me segue here a little bit, Kunal, to ask you about a popular phrase that we're hearing a lot in our interviews with corporate executives, and that's ESG. So can you talk about how you've taken up any one of those elements?
Yeah, absolutely. So probably over the last 5 to 7 years, I've been doing a lot around climate and green finance, so the E part of ESG. Mm-hmm. If you look at the journey of E, you can clearly see it's top of agenda now. The UK is hosting COP26 in November in Glasgow, and the pressure is on for commitments on climate. But what you see over 10 years is how the standards have developed for what is green, what is not green, what data needs to be disclosed, what a business should be responsible for disclosing, not just they turn on the lights, what's their electricity usage, but what's their supply chain and where are those goods coming from? Yeah. And you're now at a point of complex financial products, bonds and ETFs and equities. You see a market for green. What I'm increasingly focused on is the S part of ESG, because I feel we're at the foothills of S in the same way we were of E 10 years ago. There are a few outfits in the US which I think are really leading the charge around the S part. What's the data you need? How do you disclose it? How do you ensure consistency across businesses? How do you ensure consistency across countries? And then how do you build the products on that? The reason I'm really passionate about that is I've always been passionate about diversity and inclusion. historically, it was a tick box that corporates or governments did and they got on with their day job. Over time, that's got closer. I think in the US, the Me Too and the Black Lives Matters movements mean it's actually front and center. You're now getting to the point where it's front and center for the CEO and the decision makers. And if it gets to that point, you need to be able to measure it. You need to measure it, record it, be held accountable for it. And I see that that's growing now as well.
Can you give an example of measuring?
Yeah, so in the US, for example, companies are required for the EO1 disclosures to disclose, okay, you know, their workforce composition. That provides you as a starting point, what's the diversity for your organization? Now, that alone is not enough because you want to understand, for example, what are your provisions for maternity leave or paternity leave? What are the provisions you provide for colleagues with disabilities to actually work in your workforce? What does it look like in your recruitment behaviors and practices? Mm-hmm. How do you ensure you're actually recruiting diversely, but then also promoting in a diverse manner as well? That is complex. But to me, it sounds as complex as Green did 10, 15 years ago. So it's not insurmountable.
Yeah. Could we talk just a little bit about governance? I know this is one of Mike's specialties, but how do you think, in your role, how do you think about governance?
Yeah, I think governance in government versus business is very different. But again, a reflection of bringing in business expertise. All UK government departments have their own board. They have executive directors and non-executive directors, which includes people from industry, academia, NGOs as well. So we're held accountable not just to our politicians. Those politicians and our departments are held to account by these boards as well. That is the mechanism for feet to the fire. I guess the other bit different for government is we're held accountable through Parliament as well. So Parliament can run the rule over departments when it comes to spend and impact. Are we actually doing what we're saying we're going to do? And then there's also National Audit Office, which basically looks at whether we're spending our money well or wasting it. So there are layers and layers of governance over government. The challenge we face is to that balance between good governance and accountability and actually being wrapped around in red tape, which means we can't actually move. And that goes back to how do you take the risks in an environment where you're worried, frankly, what the consequences might be of failure.
Yeah, Kunal, I'll hand back to Mike, but I'm hearing a little bit of a theme in some of the responses on, you know, a desire for efficiency as well as effectiveness and not getting too caught in the bureaucracy or the red tape.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mike, back to you.
Okay, Kunal, I can't resist asking a question that stems from a common phrase we hear in the U.S. If we're a ranking member of one of our executive departments in Washington, an assistant secretary, let's say, for the Department of Homeland Security, we often hear that when it comes to governance, we have a board of 435 members, namely Congress. And just taking that now back to the UK, Parliament is even larger than that. So what in your own experience has been vital for you and your own department in working with that, let's call it, oversight body called Parliament?
Well, you know, a fundamental difference between the UK and the US, just looking at the politics, is government of the day in the UK has the majority in Parliament. So actually, it gets easier for the Prime Minister government of the day to bring Parliament along. Very, very different world here in the US. I think that said, though, you do not make policy in a bubble. It's all about the stakeholders that you bring along. And again, business, NGOs, media, influencers, whenever we create policy, it serves the interests of the government of the day, but the interests of the government of the day serve the interests of the nation as they see the right course of action to do. So a huge amount of the job is bringing those stakeholders along, input into consultations, responding to their feedback, persuading them as to why you think the right course of action is. One of the most amazing jobs I did in my career was during the G8, as it was then, negotiating on illicit finance and anti-money laundering. I had to speak to lawyers, I had to speak to banks, I had to speak to the World Bank, and I had to speak to NGOs, and I had to speak to G8 nations as well. Totally different constituencies, very different skills. but absolutely fascinating and necessary to do. I remember speaking to a roundtable of NGOs, being quite terrified, to be honest, because I can do government, I can do business. It was my first time speaking to NGOs, and fairly enough, rightly, they don't hold back. And it was a real learning experience.
All right, Kunal, very interesting. I just need to remind our listeners that this is Leadership in Action, Business Radio, Sirius XM, Channel 132. I'm Mike Husseim. I'm here with Anne Greenhall, and we are in active discussion with Kunal Khatri, the UK's Acting Trade Commissioner for the USA. And Kunal, before we leave that last point, let me ask about what you've learned over the years in effectively communicating with those other stakeholders. What does it take? What goes into it? What makes your message get across?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the number one lesson, and this particularly I grew whilst in China, working in China over 5 years, was effective communications is genuinely saying less and genuinely focusing on the three points that you want the person to walk away with. And three is at the high end. There's a tendency for all of us to speak too much and try and get too many points across. But I certainly learned in China where at first I didn't speak Chinese and I did speak Mandarin by the time I left. But with the language barrier on top, you need to be very precise. What do you want this person to do when they leave the room and they go back to their desks and team? So that just means speaking less. And I think, you know, communications can often be about poetry and length, but in government and business, what do you want the other side to do? You got to be precise.
Great. Super. And let's bring you in.
All right, Mike, you're heading down a path I was hoping you'd go. Kunal, just curious, do you see yourself in that role where you're talking with all of those different stakeholders as a negotiator, kind of a mediator, someone who is able, you talked about empathy earlier, able to put yourself in the shoes of the various parties and then bridge so that they can understand, talk with each other, come to some sort of common agreement or understanding?
Yeah, that's exactly the role, exactly right. And especially as a diplomat overseas, where you're not just persuading, influencing US stakeholders, big part of the job is relaying back to government in London and trying to persuade stakeholders in London, and get them to understand where the other side is coming from. So this comes back to communications.
Right.
Not just my 3 points and tell you what to do. I need to understand where your interests are, what's holding you back, and relay that back to the negotiators in the UK to get them to understand we can't just keep hitting this wall. We need to nuance and understand what might work and what might not work. So we are mediators and as well as negotiators.
Okay. And if I may, in that role, how much does your voice come out? Or are you mainly the spokesperson for others in shaping that final agreement?
Yeah, so it never works. You're an ineffective diplomat negotiator if all you do is recite the government lines, if you're the mouthpiece for government. Behind closed doors and in negotiations, there has to be that personal element, that personal insight from both sides.
Yeah. Yeah, Kunal, I just was asking you how much your voice comes through. And I heard you speak about not being the mouthpiece of the government, but then say a little more.
Yeah, so in negotiations influence, you obviously have the lines and the agenda and the objectives for government, and you're trying to persuade the other side. But the essence of negotiation comes down to that personal relationship, the quiet word in the corner. That's where you actually understand what the obstacles are on the other side, because the other side is exactly the same as you. They have their lines to take. And it's how do you find that room for maneuver negotiation such that both sides can take the next step forward? And that plays to my style of leadership, empathetic and personal. That's the only way you can really progress negotiations.
All right, Mike, if I may, one more question, then I'll hand back to you, I promise. So Kunal, imagine you're advising a young person coming up through college and thinking about wanting to be a little bit more on the world stage and play the kind of role that you've played, mediating and negotiating for various parties. What advice would you give to that young person?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. The number one thing I would say is be willing to take a risk. So I came down this path because of no design. Frankly, my parents are both family doctors, and I decided, therefore, I'm not going to be a family doctor. my dad also said, you should go into business and go and be a banker. So I decided I'm going into business. I'm not going to be a banker. And I knew I enjoyed history and politics. So I started going down this route, and nobody in my family or community had done it. So it was a risk, and I thought I'd go for it. I had no idea where I'd land. My parents still don't understand what I do. So that's number one, take a risk.
Yeah.
I actually wish I'd taken more of a risk in my life. I'd had opportunities for going abroad to do development work. Mm. And some of the breaks in my life, this is the second point actually, have come by pure chance. My first job was in Parliament because I was in an airport talking with a friend about skiing. I said, it's an expensive way to fall over. And this lady in front of me turned around and she said, she was American. She was like, that's brilliant. I love that. We started talking. It turned out, you know, she worked in Parliament and she offered me my first internship. So, you know, you find opportunities out of nowhere. A regret from my side is I've not been very good until later life at developing those relationships as mentors and as guideposts. And I think that's something I do now. And I think because I was young, I was the only one going down this path within my community. I didn't know how to do that. And that's it. That's a very important thing. And the last thing I'd say is there is less of that dividing line, government and business, politics and business. You can have public and social impact either side of the fence, increasingly so. In a world where we are being driven by science and technology. So I wouldn't get too strung up around, I'm a government person or I'm a business person. Both apply.
Oh, thank you so much, Kunal. I appreciate that. Mike.
Well, Kunal, thank you so much, Annette. And we're going to begin now to focus in just a couple minutes on the after-action review. I'm going to encourage our listeners to be thinking about a point or two they'd really like to hang on to. And then the three of us are going to talk that through. So, Kunal, really my last question here picks up on what you were just saying in response to Anne's query, and that is you are well-steeped, you're deeply in politics and the exercise of government powers, but you're rapidly learning through your job and now your educational program about business as well. So the question is, if you're talking to a 21-year-old who's finished an American university or a British university, and they're asking, should I think about politics first and business second, or should I go into business and learn politics later on? What's your guidance?
Yeah, I wonder if you asked a business exec, they'd give a very different answer. Everyone wants the other side of the fence, right?
Yep.
I think my answer would be, I actually think there's enormous value in doing the business side or NGO side or the non, if you like, public administration side before you come in. And that's the reason I'm doing this MBA, because I actually want to learn and explore and have the experience of the other side, which might include time out as well. But there are specific skill sets required for government. And that's not to say anyone in business can come in after 15 years and hit the road running and, wow, why don't we have more of these business people here? They are incredible, but it's a very different environment and it does require a lot of adjustment. So I wouldn't say it's one or the other, but I would genuinely say anyone mapping a career path, don't get too hung up on what you do first, what you do second. Just understand there is enormous value in every avenue, and whether it's the business or the political side, you will bring them to play either side that you end up on.
Yeah.
So that's a great point to pivot from, to think about our after-action review. So I'm going to start out with one modest point and then turn to Kunal and Anne, and then I'll add a final AAR summarizing point here. And that is, whether you're in politics or business, you really need to know the other side in many ways. Maybe not now, but sooner or later. To get your job done in a business, you have to know how the local mayor and district operates, not to mention Congress and the federal agencies. But the other is true as well. That is, as you move into more senior positions in the British government, you really got to have a fix on how the economy works, how companies make decisions. So we need both. And one order or the other will be our own choosing, but getting both under our hat seems like a good idea. So, Kunal, with that as the warm-up and the after-action review, what several points would you like our listeners to most hang on to from what you've said or maybe even beyond that?
Yeah, I think, you know, a few points which are just personal reflections on life. I think one is when it comes to career and your own leadership, is just take that risk. As I said, you know, life's long, careers are going to be long. Take the risk. You will have no idea what the opportunity will come out from it. I think the second is not to self-limit and understand the growth that comes from business and government and what there is to learn in between. And that is going to be par for the course for the next generation of students as well. I actually think a third one, which, you know, as part of the MBA, we didn't touch on as much, but really developing core technical skills. And whether it's data or economics, technological skills are going to be critical over the next 10, 20, 30 years. And we as government, we're going to have to absorb to a much greater degree how we deploy those skills as well.
That's great. Anne, your thought?
Great. Well, Kunal, again, thank you so much. All of these shows are always quite therapeutic for me, yet again. I've learned a lot. And you leave me with a greater appreciation of the importance of risk, as you said, and also just of chance and knowing an opportunity when it walks right in front of you. So I think that's also super important. I love your comment about not self-limiting. I have an internal editor I have to really try to quiet. It's bad enough the world puts limits on us. Let us not add to those ourselves. And maybe full circle, if we come back to our earlier discussion, there's great value in the what, in the content, the learning, the knowledge in class, or as Mike and I like to say, in the classroom of life. And the skill building, the technical skills you said that you are acquiring in school. And finally, I just like to underscore that note of reflection, how really important it is to create time and space to stop, pause, think about where we've been, where we are, and where we, you know, individually and collectively are going. So thank you. Thank you for that. Now, Mike, let me let you have the last word here.
well, thank you, Anne and Kunal, both. There's a phrase in the U.S. that I'm sure you've got in the U.K., of whether you're a B2C or a B2B company. If you're a company, the B, do you sell to consumers or do you sell to businesses? I've got the same phraseology here, P2B or B2P. And you said that if you're in politics, you really have to think horizontally, and that has implications for business for sure. I picked up on that. And then conversely, B2P, business note to politics, risk-taking is sort of the coin of the realm in business, and it's good for people in politics to understand that, to appreciate how to manage risk, and make certain that you don't get killed by it along the way. So that is, Kunal, a question that's on the more personal side. For people to learn more about you, how would they track you down on the web?
Yeah, well, they're tuning into Wharton Sirius Leadership in Action. That'll be number one.
Very good.
The second is LinkedIn, obviously. LinkedIn is the easiest way to connect and get a hold of me. And I'm very happy to speak with any businesses looking for support from UK government. But I'm also very happy to speak on a personal basis to anyone with interest on careers, and especially that diversity and inclusion space as well. Very passionate about that.
So, well, listen, thank you for joining us. Thank you so much, Anne. Great to be here with you as always. I want to just say, if you would like to know more about the show here today, you can reach us at businessradio@siriusxm.com. You can follow us on Twitter. Once again, a special thanks to our guest, Kunal Khatri. Want to thank our producer, Patty Hall, and our sound engineer, Chris Tuke. I'm Mike Husseim. I'm here with Anne Greenhall. We both work with the McNulty Leadership Program at the University of Pennsylvania. And you have been listening to Leadership in Action, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM, Channel 132.
For more guest interviews, check out our Wharton Business Radio Highlights podcast on iTunes and Google Play.